want to train hard and get strong to send your proj? I have the answer for you. This episode is sponsored by Adventure Fit Dojo. You can get 25% off a year-long membership or a 10-punch pass when you visit adventurefitdojo.com and use my code BFE25 at checkout. I'll have this linked in the show notes below. Make sure to check out the dojo and get your climb on. Hello and welcome back to the Bound for Everywhere podcast. My name is Brittany and I'm your host. In this episode, I interviewed my friend and legendary climber, Paul Robinson. Paul is the first American to ever flash a V13 boulder problem. He's the first person in the world to send 1,000 boulder problems V11 or harder. And he's also climbed 515A. These are just some of his accomplishments. Needless to say, he is one of the best climbers in the world, and I really, really enjoyed having this conversation with him. I hope that you enjoy listening to it. With that being said, this interview was conducted over Zoom, and as Zoom likes to do, it has technical difficulties now and then, so you may hear a few little lags here and there. I tried to cut it out as best as I could, and also, unfortunately, for some reason, Zoom made my voice quite a bit quieter in the beginning of the interview. It does eventually go back to normal, but it may be a little bit hard to hear me. I've tried to do everything to increase my voice, and I just can't get anything to work. So I do apologize for that, but with that being said, let's jump right into the interview. Here's a conversation with Paul Robinson.
All right. Well, welcome to the Bound for Everywhere podcast. I really appreciate you coming on and having a conversation with me. So yeah, like I was saying a minute ago, I just want to start from the beginning. So how did you first get into climbing?
I went to a birthday party. That was the very first time I ever climbed. I fell in love with it. I mean, like any kid growing up, I mean, I played baseball and soccer and kind of football, whatever, you know, I mean, all the sports you play as a kid. And I mean, I enjoyed them all, but then there was just something about climbing that kind of struck me. I really liked that it was all you. And if you failed, then that was on you. And if you succeeded, it was on you as well. And so then also too, I mean, I found it was just so unique. And I think that's what has kept me with it for all these years, is just the fact that, you know, no matter how experienced you are, the next boulder problem or sport climb or whatever is just going to be a totally unique challenge that is unlike anything you've ever done.
Yeah. I think that's really what drew me into it as well. The fact that it was like just you alone. I've never been good at team sports. It was really nice to have something totally on my own where it's like you're competitive with yourself, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, like when I was younger, I did do a lot of competitions, and it was never something that I really enjoyed, but I saw it more as something that was kind of a necessary evil for me in a lot of ways, in the sense that I did want to be a professional climber. And that was one way of really getting notoriety in the sport. And so I definitely am very happy that kind of nowadays I'm just pushing myself outside and not really doing the competition thing, because it was just, yeah, it, like you said, I mean, it was just never something that I like really felt good about, because I always just felt like I was comparing myself to others and getting really competitive and then being jealous of, you know, if someone won, et cetera. And so, yeah, it's just a much better feeling to be pushing yourself outside and not really caring what others are doing.
Yeah, I agree. So do you think, just in general, if you want to become a professional climber, you have to do competitions? Or do you think there's other ways?
I think it's highly beneficial. I wouldn't say it's the only way. I mean, like, you know, you could look at Dave Graham, for instance. I mean, he's someone that really never succeeded or really did much competition at all. But I think it just really depends on the time period that you're gaining that notoriety. You know, when I started climbing professionally, you know, getting paid or whatever to climb, it was pre-social media. And so it was the only really way to get notarized was like very hard ascents outside or climbing in competitions. And competitions were just so frequent that it was a lot easier kind of to go that path. And then I think for like a little bit, like in the like mid 2010s, outdoor climbing was very, very important to sponsors, especially with the start of social media, because it was like, oh wow, our athletes can be making videos, taking photos, things like that, and then posting them to social media. And this is this massive outlet to the world. And then now I think competition's kind of almost making that resurgence again because of not only because of the Olympics, but I think obviously the Olympics has a big part to do with it.
Yeah, definitely. So you grew up in New Jersey, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at what point did you go from climbing at the birthday party to mm-hmm. I want to do this all the time? Was it like pretty much instant?
I immediately was like, this is so fun. I mean, it's crazy. Like I can still remember kind of bits and pieces of like the very first time I climbed. And thankfully the climbing gym was really close to where I grew up. It was maybe 10 minutes away. And I would say within 1 year of starting to climb, I quit everything else. I was like, team sports, no more. And I started climbing when I was 10. I was 10. I was the youngest person at the climbing gym at this point in time in New Jersey. Climbing was, it wasn't even in like a thing really. I mean, there was no teams. There were really no kids climbing. And so I just kind of had to figure it out myself. I mean, my parents didn't climb. They were extremely supportive of the fact that I wanted to climb. And I remember my dad kind of telling me, you know, there are competitions in this. And so like, I remember doing my first like junior competitions and things like that. But yeah, I mean, Dan, you know, to answer your question, it was immediate. I loved it. And it wasn't for a while that I even knew that professional climbing was a thing. I just loved to climb and that's what I wanted to do every single day. So I'd get home from school, I'd do my homework, and I would just be like, can you please take me to the climbing gym? And then my mom or dad would hopefully take me to the climbing gym because I couldn't drive back then. And so that was it. Like, and it's kind of been the same ever since.
Awesome. So then you're growing up, you're climbing. At what point did you decide to move to Colorado to pursue it? And why Colorado?
So I was in high school, and that was kind of like right around the time 16, 17, 18 was kind of like right around the time when I started to realize that I was actually pretty good at it. And I stopped. Like I did some junior comps when I was younger, but junior comps at the time were only rope climbing. And yeah. And so then obviously bouldering's been around. I mean, John Gill's been doing it and John Sherman and stuff have been doing it for a really long time. But it was kind of like the new age thing in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I remember like watching videos of Chris Sharma and things like that and just being like, damn, bouldering's amazing. And so I quit doing the junior competitions because I didn't want to rope climb. And so I started doing the adult bouldering comps, and I was doing decently well in them. And I started to kind of, and then to go on climbing trips and stuff like that, and then got my first sponsor, etc. So anyway, at that time, like I was like a dumb teenager, and I was like, I don't want to go to college. My parents were like, okay, Well, here's the deal. You can either move out and you're on your own and you make no money, or you go to college and we will pay for it and you can continue to climb as much as you want. You can go wherever you want. And I was like, okay.
Sounds like a pretty sweet deal.
Pretty sweet deal, right? Yeah. And yet I was like 18 years old and like pissed off. But like, yeah, that's, you know, hindsight's a bitch, right?
Yeah.
So so I'm very glad that that was the ultimatum that they put on me. It wasn't obviously that bad. So I chose Colorado because I had I was doing like a lot of competitions, and I was climbing a lot with Daniel and John Cardwell and things like that. And so I'd been to Colorado for competitions as well as climbing outside. And at the time, it seems to have transitioned to Salt Lake City now, but yeah, at the time, Boulder, Colorado was the place to be. That was like, that was where you went if you wanted to pursue a career in professional climbing. I was like, well, I'm going to go to CU Boulder and I'm going to try and climb as much as possible. And then also too, kind of going back to the competition thing, I did a lot of competitions through college because traveling was a lot harder. And so it just made a lot more sense to be doing competitions then, because really all I could do during the week was train and, you know, go outside on the weekends or whatever. But it was, yeah, I was more motivated to compete then because I had the desire to train in the gym and prep myself for comps.
What did you go to school for?
I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts. Yeah.
What fine arts?
Painting.
That's so cool. I think most people might not know that about you.
No. And like, I, like through high school and through college, like painting was huge for me. I loved it. It was just such a nice creative outlet for myself. And then after graduating, I was traveling a lot. So I just really wasn't, I mean, obviously I could have, but I kind of switched passions and really started to do a lot of photo and video stuff because it complemented climbing so much. And it also too, it was just really beneficial for my sponsors at the time. But yeah, I guess, yeah, probably not that many people do know that.
Do you still paint?
On occasion. On occasion.
I want to see some of these paintings.
Okay. Yeah, I'll send you some. Yeah. I don't know if I have any pictures of any, but yeah, no, I've a lot of, I remember like back in college and stuff, I just had, you know, I lived in small apartments and whatever. And so I would just always give away paintings. And so I just had like a bunch of friends throughout the years that I would just give my paintings to.
Oh, that's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned a couple minutes ago, you got your first sponsor at 18.
Yeah, like in that 16, 17, 18, something like that. And my first sponsor was 5'10". Yep. And then that was also the first sponsor that I got paid by. And that was right around the time that I moved to Colorado. So that would have been like 19. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, a lot of sports consider like you're professional when you're getting paid to do the sport. So yeah, that's kind of like when I say, you know, I went professionals. Yeah. So 5'10 was my first sponsor. And then really soon after that, I got sponsored by Prana, which has been my longest sponsor. It's amazing. I think I was 19 years old.
Awesome.
Yeah, got sponsored by Prana and haven't left.
That's awesome. So for people like me included, who may not know how this works, when you are a climber and you start getting sponsors, do they find you and reach out to you? Like, how does that work?
It really depends. With 5'10", I remember I was in the Buttermilks and I was, yeah, I probably was around 16 or so, 15, 16, something like that. But anyway, I was in the Buttermilks and there was this guy who is now since become just a long-term friend, but I didn't know him at the time. And he and I were climbing together and he was sponsored by 5'10". And he was like, oh, cause I was wearing 5'10s. Those were kind of the shoes that I grew up climbing in. And he was like, oh my gosh, like, I think I have to introduce you to the sponsorship guy at 510. And I was like, well, that would be amazing. And so that is, I think, like, you know, I mean, the climbing community is relatively small even still. Yeah. And I think a lot of that, you know, I mean, you like, for instance, you know, I've been like, yeah, I think you should, you know, you should write to Evolve or whatever, you know? And so there's a lot of that. And then, but then there's also like a lot of, you know, scouting too and stuff. And the person that started Prana, is like a lifelong climber, and he was at a competition that I was at. And at the time, I mean, you know, also growing up too, I mean, Prana was just like the dream. Like I wore Prana like everywhere when I was a kid, cause I loved it. And that was like what climbers wore. And so, I remember he came up to me after the competition and asked if I'd like to be on the Prana team. And so, yeah, kind of just like a bit of both. And now with social media, I mean, I think it's so easy for people, and just DM a company and, you know, I hopefully have a reference or something like that.
Interesting. Yeah. I never was quite sure how that worked. Mm-hmm. And just to touch on your schooling, do you think that your fine arts degree translated into like you making YouTube videos and films and things like that?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think climbing itself is a very creative passion. However, once I graduated, I definitely felt like there was something missing. And I remember working with photographers and always just saying, oh, you know, like, how'd you make the photo look like that? Oh, why did you put the flash there? Or like, you know, why are you using that lens or whatever? And I mean, I had no idea. I didn't know what they were doing, but it was always just so interesting to me, the idea of creating something and then sharing it. And with digital photo and video, it became so easy with YouTube and all of these outlets. It was just so neat to me to be able to see something that was just created and then shared. And so, I just remember a friend of mine that was a photographer that was just like, you should just get a camera. He's like, I think you'll have fun with it. and so, that was kind of the tipping point for me. I was like, yeah, that would be really fun. And I've really enjoyed it because with today's world, you know, you've got these like this, like stationary shoe cam uncut footage, and it's like, sure, you know, I mean, there's a time and a place for it, but like there's not really just much creativity. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I feel like I've always strived to create something that people actually have like a feeling towards, not just, oh, well, that was a hard climb, cool, I'm glad I watched it. You know, rewatchability and just trying to engage the audience and also just give them a sense of place, right? Like, I mean, you know, like not many people have the opportunity to go to Font or go to Rocklands or something like that. And so it's always been kind of my goal to bring people into that landscape, into that culture, and try to share that with the world. Because there's so many unique places to see and go, and I love sharing that.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time that you really like put yourself into a video that you were creating and you were like, I'm really putting effort into this and I want to share it? And was it scary the first time? Like just kind of being vulnerable in a creative way?
Yeah, absolutely. Being creative is very vulnerable because it's kind of like out of that status quo, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, I just remember like the very first time, like picking a song, like, right? And you're like, I mean, it's funny, right? Because, you know, nowadays it's just like, I don't care, whatever. I know no matter what song I choose, like 10 people are gonna be like, sweet song, and then like 10 people are gonna be like, this song sucked, I had to listen to it on mute. And I'm just like, whatever,
you're never gonna satisfy everyone.
Exactly. But in the beginning, like you're saying, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, you're putting yourself out there. And I remember just like any criticism, I was just always like, oh God. And it just stung, you know, sitting up at night thinking about some random dude on the internet that's just like, that song sucked.
Sometimes I feel like that's the crux of creating videos and stuff. It's just finding the right music.
It is hard. It is definitely hard.
What would your advice be to someone who is maybe like trying to start a YouTube channel or wanting to get into creating films, but is kind of scared to make that jump?
Obviously, you know, like kind of like we were saying, it's easier said than done to just like, just not care about the result. But I mean, you know, the thing is, it's like everything that I've tried to put out, I've like, when I click like upload, I have a sense of pride about that. And I think that if you can acknowledge that you're proud of what you put out, and there's always going to be positive people and negative people out there, and the thing is, what really sucks is like a lot of times the positive people just watch the video and they're like, that was nice, but then it's the negative people that are coming out and saying, you know, whatever, it was lame, or the video was too long, or whatever it was. And so I think that's really important to realize that, you know, for every one person that wrote a comment that hated the video, there was probably 100 people that loved it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. And then also too, I think it's important if you're going to start a channel to be authentic. That's very easy, right? Like we were saying, like this shoe cam uncut footage. And it's at the end of the day, that's, I mean, sure, there is like a very small amount of people that want to see that. But like you look at really famous YouTubers, you know, like Casey Neistat or something like that. I mean, these are people that are not especially skilled at anything per se. I mean, obviously they're very, very skilled individuals, but they're not Olympic runners or skiers or whatever it may be. And what makes it great is that they're just showing who they are as people. And it's obviously very vulnerable to do that, to put yourself out there and be yourself and show whatever it is that you care to show to the world. But it's that's where you get the engagement, and that's where people really start to follow you. And yeah, it's great. You know, I mean, I've had so many people that write to me about the Nugget podcast that I did, just saying, thank you so much for getting out there and talking about, you know, ASD and anxiety and things like that. And 10 years ago, there's no way in hell I would have been able to talk about that. Like I did this whole video series on that, and like I was scared to do it because it's, yeah, like you said, it's vulnerable, but also too, like these people like look up to the people, like, you know, Sharma, whatever, etc. They look up and they just assume like they're just going to go climb another 515. But yeah, at the end of the day, everyone gets injured and everyone has this. And that's what I think has been so great, you know, with that podcast and with that series, is just being relatable.
Yeah, just being yourself.
Being yourself, being relatable. So I think that's really important. And I think it might be hard to do that, like right when you start a channel, but if that is kind of in the back of your head and you're kind of thinking about it and moving towards that goal, I think you'll have a lot of fun and a lot of success with that.
Yeah. No, that's awesome advice. And the Nugget podcast was fantastic. I have a couple of questions here. But to start, has there ever been anything
that maybe you posted on Instagram or YouTube that later you were like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have posted that, that you like kind of regretted?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of one thing. So this is like pre-Instagram. I remember I had like a blog.
Oh, that's super cool. What was the name of the blog?
The Adventures of Paul Robinson.
Do you still have it?
No. It's up there somewhere, though. I'm sure if you search that, it would come up. This was, yeah, this would have been, gosh, like 2006 to 2010-ish, maybe. I don't know. I don't know when Instagram came out. But, yeah, so I had a blog, and I would just talk about, obviously, the adventures of me. And so it was a great place for me to share photos and things like that. And then I remember I went to Switzerland for the very first time. It would have been 2008, I think. And I remember I saw one of Dave Graham's first descents, The Story of Two Worlds, and I hadn't really seen any pictures or videos or anything of it until then. And I remember I made a remark, and I said like that it wasn't like as cool as I thought it was going to be. And I remember that Dave got really upset about it. And it wasn't obviously like a personal jab at Dave, but yeah, it was just, it was something that at the time, again, you know, I was 20 years old or whatever, and I said something that was kind of stupid, and I was like, damn, that was probably not the best way to do it. And so, yeah, and I got some backlash for it, because at the time, you know, it's one of the hardest boulders in the world, and I was kind of criticizing it without even having tried it. And it was like an immature, kind of dumb, childish thing to say. And so that is, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's like the first kind of thing that comes to my mind as like something that I said on kind of a social media site that I was like, yeah, that was not cool.
That's interesting. That's an interesting story, but it's also been interesting that you mention A Story of Two Worlds, because I actually wanted to ask you about that a little later. And then just to kind of circle back, you recently came out on social media saying, you know, that you were diagnosed with autism. Mm-hmm. How has the response been to that? And like, how are you handling it?
No, I would say overall very positive. I've had countless people write to me saying, how did you get the diagnosis? Where did you go? I've been thinking maybe I have that, or I've been thinking my partner might have that. And so it's been great, because then I've had some people write back and say, I went to a specialist and I got diagnosed, and I feel so like relieved, and I feel just so great to like know why I am the way I am. And so it's been really, really nice. And also too, it's been really nice to talk to people who have a similar diagnosis to me, because for so long I just had this mentality of, oh, just be normal. And I was like, I guess I was like, that's what everyone says, like that's what everyone does, like, you know. And so having a kind of group that I've been able to talk to and relate with has been amazing.
It's really awesome that you found a solid group. Do you think that in climbing that you could be maybe a voice for this somehow? Have you kind of figured out that medium, or is it something you're not very interested in?
No, it is definitely something that I'm interested in. There's this Instagram account called embrace.autism that I started following, and they have a ton of followers and post diagnosis. And so I definitely have intention, because of how positive it's been. I really want to reach out to them and just see what opportunities there are. And then also too, I had a a guy write to me who has a climbing group in maybe Tennessee or Georgia or something like that, where he takes kids with autism climbing. And he was saying that it would be awesome for me to come and be a part of that group one day. And I would love that. So, it's been really, really, really positive and definitely something that I want to, just make people feel more comfortable with. Like if they don't feel comfortable talking about that type of stuff, then, you know, maybe seeing someone that they look up to talk about it could be a way for them to feel more comfortable talking about those types of things, ADHD, autism, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be great. And it would be so special for them to have you there. Mm-hmm. I think, like, you know, in general with things like that, like when Alex Johnson came out as gay, or like mm-hmm. when Caroline made the documentary about eating disorders and climbing, it's like those things aren't really talked about until there's someone who's willing to talk about them. And so I think it's really awesome that you have this kind of newfound voice in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I still feel like it was very hard to make that post, but then also too, I mean, there's just so much more that I could say and can say, and it's getting the courage to do it is it's tough.
Yeah. I mean, it's so incredibly difficult to be vulnerable mm-hmm. on social media, or just in general, but especially if you're kind of a public figure, I can't imagine how even more intense that feeling probably is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely agree. And it's, you know, like I was saying, it's that whole idealized version of your hero, right? Like for me, you know, growing up, it was Chris Sharma and Dave Graham. And then also too, like I love surfing. So like, there's like these people that I like look up to in surfing. And to me, it's like they never have bad days. They just go out and they surf incredibly and everything is sunshine and rainbows, right? But they're all living their lives and they all have their hardships and everything like that. And so it's, yeah, like you're saying, you know, it's tough because it's hard for people to relate in some ways to their heroes, and even consider that they have these exterior things that are difficult.
Yeah. And I mean, I think everyone knows this, but it's also kind of hard to really understand at the same time in real life that Instagram is just a highlight reel.
Exactly.
And so I think that you being vulnerable in that way and just other public figures being vulnerable kind of shows, hey, we're human too. We're just normal people.
Uh-huh.
And I think that opens new doors for, you know, maybe people who looked up to you in climbing and you're their hero. They're like, oh, wait, I'm not like weird for having a bad day. Like this is normal.
Mm-hmm. You know?
That's awesome. So you were also saying how you used to tell yourself like, Paul, just be normal. What in your mind was normal? And why did you feel like you were different from that?
Yeah, I think the one of the most important things, or I guess the two biggest things for me were that it's a big characteristic of being on the spectrum is like, you can't deal with change super well. And so that's always been really hard for me. And so like if a plan changes or I don't know, a flight gets delayed or something like that, it's like kind of, I have this idealized version of what my day is. It's like, okay, you know, I'm going to go to PT and now I'm going to do this podcast and then I'm going to, I don't know, go grocery shopping or whatever, like whatever the, it's like, it's kind of like almost like it's set in stone. And so as is true with every day of our lives, it's there's always flux, there's always change. And so I've always kind of like, you know, kind of just been like, close myself into this ball when change has to happen. But I've been like, okay, like I see these other people and the plan changes and everything, and they seem to be fine with it. And so I guess that's kind of like a way I normalize myself with that kind of whole aspect of change. And then also too, just like with the anxiety, it's like, I've never been a person who, like, in social situations, like if I'm with a group of close friends, then I'll feel comfortable and I can be there. But then it's like, okay, you're at a party, you know, one person, and like the rest of the people you don't know, then it's just like mental breakdown for me. And I just like, I can't think of what to say. I can't think of what to do. And I'm just like, I don't want to be here and I want to go home. And so I've basically just avoided those situations my whole life, because I fear being there more than actually being there.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I've definitely felt that way a few times. I mean, I think if you suffer from social anxiety or anxiety in general at all, you can relate to what you just said.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And I think, you know, I think again, like, right, like normalizing yourself, feeling like, okay, just be normal. There's a lot of times, and yeah, anybody with anxiety can relate to this, where it's like, you just, sometimes you're like, all right, I'm going to suck it up. I'm going to be normal and I'm going to be like everyone else. And I'm going to go to this event or party or whatever it is. And yeah. And just deal with it, because like, yeah, I mean, like, you know, it can just spiral so easily. It's like, okay, well, I know this one person, but I don't want to be like an annoying tail and just like tail this person the whole time at this party because I have no one else to talk to. And yeah. And then it just spirals. And then all of a sudden you're like, why am I even going to this party at all? And then me being me, I'm like, well, yeah, I'm going to stay home and watch Netflix tonight.
I've definitely done that several times. I mean, it can be scary, like, to go into a room full of people you don't know.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, what do we talk about?
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly.
Yeah,
you don't want the silence. It's like being scared of that silence. So like they're talking and they're saying something, but you're not even listening, because the whole time you're just thinking to yourself like, okay, well, what question can I, yeah, what question can I ask them next so that like there's no silence?
Yes. Oh my God, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly how it feels. There's been so many times that I've been in group situations where I'm like, am I being weird? Like, this silence is really awkward. Somebody needs to say something. I feel like I have to say something, but I don't
exactly
know what to say.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're like, but then you're like, well, why is it put on me? Why isn't someone else saying something?
Yeah, and then the longer it goes, the more awkward it gets. It's just terrible.
Oh, that's so funny. Yes, totally relate.
Oh, well, that's awesome. I think that it's great. You're going to change so many lives just like working with people who suffer from any sort of anxiety or are on the spectrum at all. It's going to be great. So I'm very excited for you to kind of dive into that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Kind of circling back to climbing, I'm kind of curious to ask you this. Uh-huh. So I think a misconception in climbing, or at least in my opinion, is that you have to be naturally gifted to climb like V15 or 515, you know, et cetera. But do you think that for the average person, if they have the drive and they're willing to put in the training, do you think it's possible for them to also reach that level?
How old were they when they started climbing?
I don't know. Let's say 15, or me. I started climbing at 24.
Yeah. That's obviously there are anomalies. Don't get me wrong. But as I'm sure you're very well aware, the earlier that you start something, the more likely you are to succeed at it. And I wouldn't, you know, obviously there are body types that are more prone to being good at climbing. But I think that the people that start climbing pre-puberty are much, much better off because it forces technique over power. And what I've seen time and time again is someone starts climbing and they start climbing, you know, in their 20s or whatever. They have some, you know, maybe some gymnastics or lifting experience or whatever. And so they're relatively fit. And they get to climbing 512, they get to climbing V6 or V7, and then all of a sudden they kind of get stumped. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's all about the mindset in that case, right? So there's a lot of people that get to that point and then they don't understand why they aren't getting stronger, or not stronger per se, but why they're not getting better. And it's because they skipped one of the most crucial steps, and it's getting technique, learning how your body moves on the wall, learning how to read a climb before you even pull onto the starting holds. And so I would say, yes, I think you could start, you know, 15 to 25 and you could have a ton of success, but I think that it's just really imperative to realize that climbing is so much more than pulling yourself up the wall. There's all of the technique and the mental side and everything like that. And so I think that's why you see a lot of burnout and why you see a lot of people saying, oh, I'm never going to be able to climb V10. I'm never going to be able to climb 514. Because they're not willing to put in the time to strengthen the other parts of climbing that aren't quote unquote the fun parts.
Right. Yeah. There's definitely parts of climbing that are not as fun as just going climbing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
But so say somebody was willing to put in the work for the technique, for the training and the weights and like hangboarding, yeah, and all of that, they would most likely be better off. Do you think that they could climb at an elite level, or they would maybe kind of plateau before then?
I think, yes, I think that they could absolutely climb at an elite level. That's not to say I don't believe that they are at a slight disadvantage. Mm-hmm. Because I think when you climb, when you are going through puberty, through your teen years, your body grows muscle groups to make you excel at climbing, because that's kind of what your body's pushing itself towards. But again, that's not to say, I mean, I have seen many people start in their 20s and climb at a very, very high level. I think it's about motivation and putting the time in is really what it comes down to. But yeah, other than like the slight disadvantage, I don't see why anyone can't push themselves to where they want to be.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I was actually in my last episode that I recorded last week, I was talking about this, how I think a lot of people go into climbing with kind of a limited mindset, like, oh, I'll never climb that grade. Mm-hmm. But if you go into it with that mentality, you're less likely to do it. I think it's better to be like, I could do anything, even if it's unrealistic, you know, and maybe
Absolutely. And too, I mean, starting later, when I started climbing, I think, probably like V13 or V14 was the hardest grade in the world. And so that was kind of the ceiling. And now you look at it and kids that are starting these days or adults or whomever, the ceiling is just so incredibly high that, there's just so much to strive for.
Definitely. So kind of going along with that, say someone just got into climbing recently, or maybe they've been climbing for a couple of years and they want to climb really hard. What would your best advice to them be? Is there like something that you see most climbers make that's just like a big mistake in the beginning or that they could do better?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most important things is not getting injured. I think a lot of times people will start maybe hangboarding too early, and then they'll get a finger injury. And as we all know, you can't really get much stronger when you're injured. So I think it's important to be cognizant of that. Be aware that the small fibers and small muscle fibers and things like that that build finger strength are very prone to injury, and also to take a long time to develop. Whereas a lot of you go to the gym and you could start bench pressing and you're just going to kind of continually get better just because it's just a lot larger muscle group. And so I think that's very important. And then also climbing is such a lifelong soul journey that it needs to be realized by someone that's going to start climbing and wants to climb really hard that there's going to be ups and downs the entire way, and that it's not something that you're just going to get really good at overnight, because climbing is not something that is purely strength focused. It's so mental, so technical, and I mean, I know I've said this like in podcasts and things like that before, but to me, it's like a book, right? It's like every time you go climbing, you're just writing one more page on that book. And so, you know, maybe you learn like a new way to heel hook, or maybe you learn like, if I have my body like this, then I can keep my feet on the wall better on steep walls or whatever it may be. And so there's obviously our bodies have limitations, you know, I mean, I don't think someone that's 80 years old is ever going to climb V15, but I think that someone that's 80 years old that's been climbing for 50 years will just have such an incredible knowledge of the sport. And that's really what is the most important thing. And that's really how you are going to eventually get to an elite level, is having that, you know, like they say, 10,000 hours or whatever, but or 10,000 pages in your book. And so that's really how I see it, is just taking your time to enjoy the process more than the end goal.
That's great advice. Speaking of the mental aspect of it, you've been climbing for a long time. So how do you stay motivated to continue pushing yourself?
Well, I think what is really important is, I mean, I love climbing. I always love climbing. I don't think there's ever going to be a point in time where I don't want to climb. So I think that obviously helps. I think people that struggle with motivation at times, I'm not saying they don't love it, but, you know, sometimes and obviously too, I've struggled with motivation before as well, but it's just all about realizing that there are so many facets to climbing. Sometimes I get super psyched on training and I'm like, you know I like outdoor climbing more than I like indoor climbing, but I just want to climb inside for 2 months. Or on the rare occasion, I'll want to go sport climbing. and so, I think that that's what's so unique with climbing, is that I find every facet of it to be so unique, every move to be so unique. And so maybe I'll go to my project and I'll have a crappy day on it and I'll just be like, I'm so sick and tired of trying this thing. But then the next day I'll be like, oh, I want to go to the gym and I'm going to moonboard for 3 hours and I'll have an awesome time. And so it's just all about finding where your motivation lies and kind of following that path.
I love that. So kind of getting into the fear aspect and how you're like, oh, sometimes I like to sport climb. Uh-huh. How do you manage your fear, especially on like high ball boulders? Because they just look so terrifying to me.
Uh-huh.
But like lucid dreaming, for example, when you're over the lip and if you fall, you're dead. How do you control your mind?
Well, I think it takes a lot of time to kind of get to that point. But so for instance, right, like you set a climb on the kilter board and mm-hmm. you try it 10 times and then you do it. And then you go back to the gym the next day and someone's like, tell me a really fun boulder problem on the kilter board. And you're like, oh, I set this one yesterday. And mm-hmm. and guess what? You're probably going to do that climb first try, right? More than likely, right? And I think that is where you kind of have to be with high ball bouldering, because all of these things that are like really tall, like lucid dreaming or any other kind of high ball boulder, you're rehearsing it on top rope countless times. And so as you get to an advanced or elite level, you can really rely on that kind of like that kilter board kind of aspect that I just explained. Like, you know, you're going to do it first try again. And that's kind of like what it's like with these high balls, is that you've done it so many times on a rope that by the time you get up there and you're just doing it as a boulder problem, it feels so natural. And yeah, obviously there's fear and there's this sense that like, wow, I could fall and really mess myself up. But at the same time, it's this like idea that I've done this so many times and it's going to be okay. Just do it exactly like you did before.
Interesting. Have you ever had a scary fall?
On a high ball? No, I remember I was topping something out once in Switzerland and I got over the lip and it was super, super cold that day. And like, I couldn't feel my fingers and I couldn't feel my feet like in my climbing shoes.
Oh my goodness.
And the lip of the boulder was maybe only like 15 feet, but then it had like a 25 foot slab, but really like really easy slab. Like if it was nice outside and you could feel your feet like and everything, like you'd be fine. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like didn't know where to go, but like the landing kind of dropped off behind like the overhang. So no one could kind of like guide me. They were just kind of under the overhang. And I was like, all right, well, like I just had sent the climb. Like I'd never practiced the top out or anything, because everyone was like, yeah, it's easy. And so I got up there and it was easy, but I was just so cold. And I just remember kind of like being on there and like using my hip on the slab.
Oh my gosh.
It's like death gripping. Like, okay, you're going to be fine. Oh, and just like being so scared that I was going to fall, but there was nowhere to go because like I couldn't go down because I'd have missed the landing. And I like just kind of had to go up and I didn't really know where to go, but thankfully I was fine. And then I had a very similar experience probably like 10 or so years ago with Daniel, where he put up this first ascent and he rehearsed the top on top rope and he was like, yeah, it's easy up there. And I remember getting up there kind of past the no fall zone and just being like, this is not easy.
Oh no.
Like full on like V4 or V5. And like, again, you know, probably not going to fall, but to the point where you're like 30 feet up and you're like, this is not okay. Like, I don't feel good here.
Like it's not jugs.
No. It's like actual moves and you're climbing and there's no physical way that you can come down. And I think that's really where it gets scary, is when like there's a point where there is no coming down. And that's a tough place to kind of turn your head off from, because it's very easy to kind of get a little like overstimulated in that kind of aspect where it's like, holy shit, I can't go down. I have to go up now.
Yeah, I imagine that could be quite terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in the Nugget, you mentioned that you work boulder problems from the top down. Is this why?
Yes. Well, I mean, not necessarily. I mean, because a lot of the climbs I do are maybe 15 feet tall and you could fall on any move and be fine. But I work climbs from the top down, no matter how hard the top out is, even if it's like V2, I will do it. Because we have all fallen past the crux of our project.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the worst feeling ever.
I know.
And so, you know, I don't want to feel that feeling, you know, because if you fall off the crux, you're like, well, shit, that sucked. All right. I fell off the crux again. But then you do the crux and then you fall. Then you're so just bummed. And there's no one to blame except for yourself for not making sure 100% that you had the top dialed.
Yeah. So how does that work with working it from the top down? Okay, this is like a classic person who doesn't climb, even though I do climb. How do you get the rope up there? Like, do you just find an easier way around the boulder? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, usually. Usually, I mean, so if top down doesn't necessarily mean like I'm using a rope, right? I could just like, I don't know, someone could boost me up to like a good hold and I could just do the top out. And that's like, and then I've done the top and then, okay, let me do the crux. And it's like, okay, cool. Let me start trying the beginning moves. All right, cool. I'm going to try the whole boulder now. That's like, you know, very common, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, usually when you set up usually there's an easy-ish way. I mean, I know you've climbed a lot in the Buttermilks and stuff like that. So It's not nearly as easy there, but a lot of the things in the Buttermilks have bolts on the top, which is quite nice. But in Font or places like that, I'm sure in Tahoe as well, from having seen pictures, it's like there, you just tie a figure eight around a tree and then you climb up the backside of the boulder, put the rope down, make sure that the rope's not going to move, because that can be scary sometimes. Like if the climb's on like an arete or something, it's kind of scary because like the rope could slide. And so you just make sure you can set a directional or whatever you need. And then usually what I do is, I'll just wrap in and then, just self belay. I know I call it top roping, but more or less just self belay myself, with a gree-gree, as I'm trying the moves.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Does that make sense? Yeah. You just tie it below the gree-gree. So it doesn't slip. And then, you lower yourself. You're just using one line. So you just lower yourself down to where you want to start. And then you climb. And then if you're at like a good hold, you can kind of pull up the slack on the gree-gree. But usually I use a static line. So it's not like you're falling far distances. Static lines are really good for working climbs.
Okay. That's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense now. Because I was like, I never really understand how they get it up there.
Yeah. The tree at the base on the backside.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about rope climbing before, and how you kind of have a love-hate relationship with it. But so for those that don't know, you've sent Jaws, which was 15A, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Supernova was what, like 14D?
B, yeah, 14B. And then I did like Psychedelic in St. George, which was 14D. I mean, everything I've done has been short. I don't want to like, and that's what's so interesting with rope climbing, right? I mean, I know you have a question, but like everything that I've done that's been hard has probably been less than 60 feet.
That's my kind of rope climbing.
No, it's not. You're climbing free rider.
Well, okay. Trad climbing, I like longer climbs, but sport climbing, I get way too pumped to do anything longer like 60 feet.
I know. I remember in Turkey once, we were there for the Petzl Rock trip, and we were at this wall, and the easiest thing there was like 12C. And everyone was like, yeah, we're going to warm up on this 12C. And I was like, all right, cool. Like, but it was like 40 meters or something. Like we had 100-meter rope for this wall. And so, I mean, 40 meters is like 130 feet or so. And so I get like halfway up this 12C that everyone just like did super easily. And I was like, I can't, there's no way. I can't do this thing.
Ripped out of my mind.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Oh and my gosh, so, I know that feeling too well.
Yes, I think it's right. It's like the difference between a sprinter and a long distance runner.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so we've talked about this before a little bit and how like you get a little bit scared on ropes.
Mm-hmm.
So with pushing yourself on sport climbs like Jaws or Supernova, what made you motivated to do that? And why do you think it is that you kind of go back and forth with it?
I guess it's a two part. One, I feel like falling on a rope, I just don't really like the feeling of it. And I mean, obviously it freaks me out. Don't get me wrong, but like,
me too.
Yeah. It's just like, I don't like the, like with bouldering, right? It's kind of, I don't know. Maybe it's just like internal me, right? So with bouldering, it's like, if I'm going to fall, I'm not like a type of person that's like, oh, I have a spotter now. Okay. I can go 120% because he's going to catch me. Like I'm like, every time I climb, I am fully aware of the fact that this is on me. Mm-hmm. And if I fall, I need to be prepared, and I'm not that I'm not trusting my spotter, but it's like, I want to be fully in control of the situation. And it's, again, like, it's not like I'm even thinking that my belayer is going to drop me, but there's just a lot more added to it, right? You've got this rope and you have a belayer, and when you fall, like you fall and then you swing a direction, or like if you're on a vertical wall, you're kind of like, you hopefully aren't going to like hit things. And so I think I just really get in my head a lot when I'm sport climbing, because I'm just constantly thinking about what the outcome is going to be. Like if I fall now, what is it going to be like? If I fall after I clip this bolt, what's it going to be like? If I skip this bolt, like, is that will I hit the ground? And so I can't really get into that flow state when I'm sport climbing, because I have too many other kind of anxieties in my head, and I'm not thinking about the movement as much as I am thinking about these other aspects of the climb.
That makes sense.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah. Because I struggle with the same thing. I love rope climbing. It's mm-hmm. my favorite type of climbing, but it does really scare me. I do not like the feeling of falling. And then I've found that, you know, the last year or so, I had just this paralysis of fear where I couldn't even move above a bolt or gear of any kind.
Uh-huh.
And I was just paralyzed with fear because I was like, I could fall at any second. And then you get in your head and you're like, oh, well, now I'm just going to come down. I can't do anything.
Yep.
And yep. It's terrible. So it's just like a constant managing of fear for me.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, and that takes, I think it takes a lot of the fun away, because I love like looking at a move and just having every little ounce of my body like in my awareness, like, okay, like my foot's doing this, my knee's doing this, my hip's doing this. And like, once I stick the hold, I have to do this. And it cripples my ability, mm-hmm. In a lot of ways. And so kind of going back to the original question, you know, how did I climb those hard climbs? I think I got to the point where I forced myself to take those falls enough that I knew what was going to come if I did fall, that I was able to eradicate those fears enough that I could climb more like myself than, like if I'm doing a 512, like if someone's like, yeah, let's do this 512, then the entire time, like I'm not having any fun. I'm just like up there, like, this sucks. I'm terrified of like the ledge or like, I don't want to go to the next bolt because I don't know if I'm going to be able to clip from that position or whatever. But then, yeah, if I work something out, then I kind of have an idea of what is to come, how I would fall, et cetera. And then again, why I don't like rope climbing as much. And I think I told you this before, but it's just, I'm so uncomfortable when I'm trying to like work up. Like I get to the point where I'm like working this sequence 50 feet in the air and I've been up there for 30 minutes and I'm like, I feel bad for my belayer who's just sitting there. I'm like, they don't want to be down there. Just like catching me over and over and over again. And then I'm like, my climbing shoes hurt. Like my freaking like back of my legs hurt super bad from sitting in this harness. And I just get so fed up with the fact that I'm like working this move and I'm not on the ground. Then I'm just like, all right, I'm just going to just lower me. Let's go home. That's yeah. And it's like, it sucks. Cause I mean, I love every aspect of climbing. I love, you know, like the easy trad I've done and the sport climbing I've done and the bouldering I've done. I just have a hard time with some of the aspects of other things. And don't get me wrong, I mean, there are things that I hate about bouldering too. So
so here's the interesting thing is that the other day you told me that you've always wanted to climb LCAP, which
yeah.
is something a lot of people probably don't know. But yes. Is that something you think you might actually do?
Yes. I would really like to climb LCAP. I would like for Tommy to take me up.
Me too. Can we do a party of three?
Perfect. No, he's told me so many times before. He's like, I'll take you up. And I'm like, okay. Like, I need to just do it one of these days because I would like to, because it's so incredibly classic, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that every facet of climbing kind of has that thing. And I mean, with trad climbing, that's the thing. And to yeah. also be able to like see, so, like there's so much history, right? Like, I mean, if I was to do it, I'd love to. I mean, and again, like I would want to do it. I wouldn't care if like I didn't successfully send some pitches or whatever, but just to like try the Great Roof, like where, you know, Lynn Hill like, doing that back in the day and like all the dudes being like, holy shit, like that's amazing. How the hell did she do that? Oh, and idol. Like, corners pitch and all that stuff. Like, I mean, I would be scared out of my mind. I can't even imagine how scared I would be, but at least, you know, I mean, it would be something that I feel like I would want to push myself to do because of how iconic it is. And just like the experience that you'd get from it.
Yeah. I think it's just such an incredible formation. I mean, it blows my mind every time I look at it.
I know. I've never even seen it.
You've never been to Yosemite?
No, I know.
Oh my gosh, you have to go.
I know. When I come to Tahoe, maybe I'll try and do both because...
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah, we should do that.
Because, yeah, because they're close.
Yeah, it's very close. And in November, like early November, it's still really good in the valley.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, like the bouldering there is insane. Maybe you could show me how to actually boulder something in Yosemite. I haven't figured it out yet.
It looks hard.
It's very hard. But is there a route on LCAP that like specifically you'd want to do? Is it the nose or is it maybe something else?
Yeah. I mean, I'd probably want to do the nose. And again, like I said, you know, it would not be about, I have to lead every pitch or anything like that. It would just be, that's the iconic route. And that would be pretty badass to go try.
Oh yeah. So do you think that at some point you might get into trad climbing a little more, or is it just like not really on your radar?
I think if I'm going to get into something else now in my 30s, it would be sport climbing first. Nice. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what my neck has to say for itself. I don't know how much more time I have with bouldering. Hopefully I have a couple more years, but sport climbing is definitely a lot more lenient on my neck, which, I mean, and if that's the case, then, you know, I'm just going to have to learn to love sitting in a harness and find someone that doesn't care if they are belay bitch for an hour.
Yeah, obviously,
but it's like, you know, I just always feel bad.
Yeah, I personally don't mind belaying at all, because it's kind of like, I mean, if someone falls, you're like sitting there, you're like, okay, this is fine.
yeah totally.
But I know a lot of people are kind of funny about it, and they're like, I don't want to belay you for an hour. But I'm like totally the opposite. I'm like, I don't really care. I'm just chilling.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing, is even if someone tells me that, I'm still just like so self-conscious. And I'm like, I just don't, but you know, I just know it obviously, like, you know, it's like not that comfortable to belay and catch someone falling for an hour. Yeah. And so I just get to the point where I'm like, I'll belay someone for an hour. I don't care. But I do understand like the strain and like kind of annoyance that there is behind all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So kind of transitioning back into bouldering. I don't know if you know this, but I lived in Nashville for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
Before Colorado. Okay. Yeah, I did tell you that. Mm-hmm. And that's where I first started climbing. And so I was watching Uncharted Lines the other day, which was a great film, by the way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I saw where you were in Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh man, that's so cool that all of this like world-class bouldering was there. Because when I lived in Nashville, I was kind of unaware of that. I was like really only in sport climbing. Mm-hmm. But I was watching King of Contortion. That was the craziest route to climb.
Yeah. That's in the Obed.
Oh, okay. Is that where you were?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think I caught that.
The Obed is kind of, we didn't really call out the areas because like a lot of them were like kind of hit or miss on like public, private property stuff. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, from being from Tennessee, I'm sure you know, it's like a little sketchy out there in that sense. Yeah. So, and then also some of the areas that we went to, some of the people, they were like, yeah, you can film it, but don't say where it is. And so, like that big roof thing that Jimmy does, the Hell's Gate one.
Yeah.
That like totally secret. And I've had so many people ask me, and I'm like, sorry, like we promised we wouldn't tell anyone where that is. But but yeah, a couple of those things are like, because Nashville, no. Wait, is Nashville near the Obed?
So Nashville is about 3 hours from the Obed.
Oh, because Nashville's to the west.
Yes. And so Obed is over more by Knoxville.
Knoxville. Yeah, I get both of those confused. Because Jimmy grew up pretty close to Knoxville, and we were staying at his mom's house for a lot of that time. And when we were, because we were climbing like all around the Obed.
Oh, okay. Yes. I've been to the Obed a few times, but never for bouldering. It's really cool out there.
Oh, it's amazing.
I watched you do that boulder and I was like, that is the craziest roof climb I might have ever seen. And I'm wondering like how many tries did it take you and what goes into figuring out the moves on an FA like that? Because when I walk up to boulders, most of the time I'm like, I have no idea what to do here. This doesn't make any sense.
Uh-huh. thankfully, you know, Jimmy and I worked it together. And it was really cool to kind of figure it out. And when you have like another set of eyes, especially, I mean, someone of the caliber like Jimmy, I mean, it's cool because like I see a climb in one way, Jimmy sees it in another way, and you kind of combine that effort together, and all of a sudden you find the easiest way to get up the thing. And yeah, I don't remember who it was that found out that knee bar. But we were just blown away when you do a 180 degree turn, and I mean, it feels like your hip is just going to rip out of the socket.
It looked like it too.
Yeah. And, but yeah, that was the only way that we figured out how to do it.
It was super cool. Is that something that maybe is like a little bit difficult with putting up FAs? It's just figuring out the movement, or does it come pretty naturally to you?
Really just depends. It depends on the climb. I mean, some climbs, you know, I'm sure you've done climbs outside where it's just like right, left, top out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Super, yeah.
You can have right, left, top out, and you can have V14, V15 boulder problems with that. But then it becomes crazy too, like, you know, like an intricate knee bar or like a weird heel toe cam. Like, I remember I put up a climb in South Africa a couple years ago that I did this like this big toe in move for the crux, and then Dave and Nale found a heel toe cam, and it just made the crux like astronomically easier.
That's cool.
So yeah, sometimes you just don't see it. And I was working the climb by myself, and I had some friends who were trying it too, but it was maybe a little bit difficult for them, so it wasn't like they were realizing new ways to kind of to climb it. But then yeah, with that, and that happens all the time. Someone will find a knee bar, someone will find like a heel toe cam or something like that. And then, and that's why like second and third and fourth and fifth ascents, et cetera, are so important to solidifying a grade and things like that. And again, right, we're talking about vulnerability earlier. I mean, doing a first ascent and calling it a grade is so vulnerable.
Oh, but yeah.
You're like, okay, all this, you know, 5'11" or the 10 or whatever it is. And it is, yeah, I mean, you know, anything could happen. Someone could downgrade it because they find a move that is, makes it way easier. Someone could downgrade it because they have spite and they don't like you or whatever it may be. It's really nerve-wracking to do a first ascent in that sense. Because almost more so than making a video in my head. I mean, I've had things that have been upgraded, downgraded, whatever, but like, gosh, when something gets downgraded, it's just like, you feel it in the pit of your stomach. Like, oh damn. Like, you know, cause you don't, it's so personal, right? You're like, all right, this thing feels freaking hard to me. I'm going to call it V15. And then someone comes along and it's like, no, actually this feels like V13. And there's a lot of grading out there these days and things like that, that you're like, okay, well, like it seemed like they probably graded this because they wanted notoriety. And so that's never really been my intention, but like, it's hard to see past that if something gets like a double downgrade or something like that. And then all of a sudden, then you get the haters that are like, well, he just graded that so that it would be newsworthy or whatever. And yeah, I mean, you see that a lot.
Yeah, I imagine that's really tough. That's something I've thought about before, because I mean, I've really only put up FAs on the Kilter board, but it's like, whenever I set a new problem, I always try to find whoever's in the gym and I'm like, hey, can you climb this and tell me what you think it is? I know what I think it is, but I need a second opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And with outside stuff, I mean, that's just not always a possibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine, like, I feel like I would not want to grade something and wait until somebody else did it to see what they thought.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the mentality that Sharma has taken for many, many years. I mean, he was like, I'm just not going to grade it. But yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really tough because you don't want to overgrade it because you don't want to look like someone who's just doing something for the notoriety, and you don't want to undergrade it because, you know, you don't want people being like, wow, he's such a sandbagger. And so you're just, yeah, I mean, there's really no way to succeed at grading things. I remember Carlo once told me this quote that stuck with me that was really funny. He was like, when I grade a first ascent, I like start counting down, and then like whatever grade it is. So like if he's like, all right, V13, okay, V12. And then he's like, whatever grade I get to, and I laugh because there's no way it could possibly be that grade, that I'll call it that grade because then it won't get downgraded.
That's a good way to look at it.
I know. I thought that was really funny.
That is funny.
Like, that's a really funny way to look at it.
Kind of circling back to earlier when you mentioned A Story of Two Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
I remember also in the nugget you talking about total eclipse and how like that was the boulder problem for you. Mm-hmm. And when I was watching The Shangan Files as well, another great film, and I watched you do A Story of Two Worlds, and I was like, what total eclipse was to you is what A Story of Two Worlds is to me. I'm like, that is just like the coolest boulder problem ever in my head.
Hell yeah.
So it's funny that you're like, oh, it doesn't seem that cool. You know?
No, what's really funny is like, I like totally retracted that statement afterwards. And I was like, man, I feel like such a douchebag for saying that. Because it's like, when you go there, it's like, it's amazing. When you climb on it, it's phenomenal. Like the dagger, the stand start, it's like every move is so intricate and unique, and it just requires so much. Like you can't go there super strong and just expect to do it. Like you have to be good at toe hooking. You have to be good at heel hooking. You have to have decent endurance, and you have to be able to pace yourself. And we've all seen 5-star lines, right? Like, I mean, you've been to the Buttermilks. I'm sure you've seen the Mandala, right? Like this beautiful freestanding boulder where you're like, wow, mm-hmm. this is bouldering in a nutshell. And so I think, I think in a lot of ways, I think that statement that I made was like, okay, this isn't that, but I think I was, I was just naive. Like I hadn't done many first descents at that time. I was really young, and I was like, I hadn't done many first descents. And like, I was seeing beauty only in the look of the climb, not necessarily the movement. And, that trip, I didn't even actually end up trying it. But then I came back in 2010, and that's when I like worked it and ended up doing it. And yeah. And like the whole time I was like, man, I'm such a jackass for like having said something like that. Like, that's just not cool. And yeah, I think there's so much more to a boulder than just how it looks. Because there could be something that's, I mean, like very funny kind of instance, like there's this boulder that I in Colorado that I've been really excited to try. And if you look at it, you're like, that is one of the best boulders I've ever seen. And then you climb on it and it doesn't climb that well. And and it's just not that fun to climb on. You're kind of just like heel hooking, but dragging your body the whole time. And it's just not that enjoyable to climb on. And so I think it takes a lot more than just how a climb looks to make it really good. And I think I was just very naive and just very much like not looking at it from the perspective of what it really was and what it stood for in climbing. And so I think that's pretty badass that's like kind of a dream boulder for you, because
thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean it's sick, and it stood for so much for so long, because I mean, that thing has so much history, and it's really cool. And it requires you to be an extremely well-rounded climber to do it.
Yeah, it looks like it. I mean, there's just so much that goes into that.
Mm-hmm. From
what you've said and then watching the video, it does not look easy.
No.
What went through your head when you did it? Did you think you could do it the whole time, or were you kind of doubting yourself, or how did that work?
Mm. So, yeah. So for me, I mean, I did the dagger quickly, and then I kind of worked out the moves on the bottom relatively quickly. So I kind of knew I could do it, but the endurance aspect was what was really hard for me. I fell in the dagger section so many times, just because I didn't have the endurance, or, I mean, you know how it is when you get tired, you make small mistakes and then all of a sudden you're on the ground, especially if it's a climb that's at kind of your peak ability. And so, yeah, I remember 2 days before I did it, I climbed through the entire crux and I got to the end, like the V3 end. And I was really tired, and I'd rehearsed this a million times before, but when you're tired, you know, I mean, your body kind of gets sloppy. And so I remember I went kind of for the final jug, and my hip hit this tree, and I was like, no, I just could not believe it. I was like, I dabbed on the end, and my hip hit the tree, and I was like, I can't count this. Like, this is like one of the, like, this will be like the hardest thing I've ever climbed. And I was so upset. And the next day I rested, and I was in Switzerland with a buddy of mine, and like, we went climbing, and the whole day he was like trying to cheer me up, and he's like trying to get my mind off of it. And I was just so bummed. And I was like, I don't know if I can get back there again. And there wasn't much time left before I was flying back to the United States. And I was just like, oh my gosh. And I remember we went back there after a rest day, and I just did it. And I was just like, thank God. And so in a lot of ways, it was kind of anticlimactic, because I had more or less done it 2 days prior. But also too, I mean, obviously it was so special, because that boulder, right? I mean, that boulder houses Dreamtime and the Story of Two Worlds. And to do both of those were just like, you know, Total Eclipse or any of these climbs. I mean, these were climbs that I had heard about and seen pictures of and videos growing up, and never, ever thinking I would even have the chance to try them.
Yeah, that's so cool. I imagine that was such a full circle moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. I have a couple more questions, and then I want to jump into listener questions, if that's okay.
Okay.
So you're about to make your first trip back to Rocklands since 2018. Uh-huh. Do you have your eye on any specific climbs, or are you looking at more FAs? What does that look like?
Yeah. I'm sure I'll maybe get excited on some first ascent stuff, but I am really excited to try some of the stuff that's been established, because I haven't spent too much time in Rocklands over the past 6 or 7 years, because I found this other area in the Cedarburg that I did a lot of development in, and that was kind of my main focus. And then during that time, Dave and Daniel and Jimmy and Giuliano, those guys put up a lot of really hard climbs. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be kind of nice. Like, I feel like you have to have the mindset of like, okay, I want to go do first ascents. And because it's just, yeah, it's so much more. Whereas with doing a repetition of something, it's like, okay, I've got a YouTube video right in front of me. Okay, that he goes right hand there. Okay, moves his left foot there. And it's about just completing the movements and topping the boulder out. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm excited to go there this season, not having tried a lot of these harder lines that those guys put up, and test myself on them, because, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that I'd like to try, kind of obscure things that don't have that many ascents. And then that Nale thing, like the finish line, I think I kind of want to try. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. Trust issues, get railed, so many things.
Do you think you'll be making a YouTube video about it?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, I was talking to Prana the other day. I think I'm going to do, so like in Waco, I did dailies, but with a 2 month trip, it would be pretty hellish to do dailies. So I think I'm going to do like every 7 to 10 days, do like weeklies.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to watching that.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be fun.
Yeah, so you just also herniated another disc, didn't you?
Yes. So when I got my first MRI, when I found out that I needed surgery, the cervical spine, I think it's like C1-7 or something mm-hmm. like that. It doesn't matter. But anyway, I had herniations in like pretty much all of them. And 4, 5, 5, 6 were the worst. And when they do surgery, insurance will like pay for a max of 2. I don't know. Yeah, you know how it is. We live in America.
Yeah.
It's a shit show. So, for the European listeners, you guys are all much luckier than we are with healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So they fixed the ones that were the worst.
Okay.
And and then so I went to the orthopedic surgeon and I told him about what was going on. I told him about the surgery because it was a different doctor, but told him about the surgery and everything like that. And he was like, yeah, I mean, it sounds like you have another herniated disc, because you start to kind of get like numbness and you get tingling in your fingers and stuff like that when you have herniated discs, because the herniation is pressing on the nerve in that like spinal column. And mm-hmm. so you get this like these tingling sensations, and it's actually really interesting because with the first one, it was on the right side. And so like my thumb and first two fingers, they would like be tingling all the time. And then that's exactly where that 4, 5, 5, 6, like that's where the herniation was the worst. And so, I kind of had that like kind of numbness and tingling in my left arm. But thankfully, I went to my physical therapist and he was like, yeah, I feel so much different this time. Like, he's like, you haven't lost strength. I think that you have, obviously you had these herniations and obviously there's some swelling in that kind of column area. And so like the nerve is a little bit pissed off, but he's like, I don't think it's to the point where you're going to need surgery. So we did a bunch of PT last week and then doing more this week. And I'm kind of I'm just doing some sport climbing at the gym and some like really, really steep kilter boarding to make mm-hmm. sure that I'm not taking like those jarring falls on my, cause it's not even like landing like on my back or anything like that. It's like when you take a big fall, your neck takes a lot of stress.
Oh yeah.
And that's sure. That's where the doctors think it all came from. And I think that, you know, everyone kind of has a weak point in their body, whether it's your shoulders or your elbows or whatever it is. And I think mine just happens to kind of be my neck area. So I've got a lot of exercises now to work on, and I have not lost strength in either arm. So
that's good.
As long as I can kind of like keep my neck strong, and not take any super jarring falls, I think hopefully I'll be good for my trip.
Does it make you a little bit nervous for your trip? Or do you yes. think it'll be yes. fine?
I'm hoping it will be fine. I'm staying positive because, it would suck. It would really, really suck. And I'm just trying not think about it because, that would be a real bummer to get there and be a week in, be all psyched on my projects. And then like all of a sudden, it was overnight with the last one. I mean, the herniations were there, but the extent of the herniation, like I just woke up and all of a sudden I could barely do any pull-ups. Like, I mean, I couldn't do any pull-throughs at all on my right arm.
Wow, that's crazy. I imagine that was like, what is going on?
Yeah, I was like, I have no idea what's happening.
That's scary. Well, I'm going to stay positive for you. You're going to send your projects and have fun surfing. It'll be a great
yes, show. All of those things.
Yeah. So let's jump into a few listener questions.
Okay.
All right. So does Paul plan to push beyond the grades he has been establishing for more than a decade? So do you think V16 maybe in your future?
I would love to. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some things in Colorado, the box therapy one, hypnotized minds, that I would love. Yeah. I would absolutely love to do. And that was really my intention, you know, before hurting myself, about 2-ish years or so now ago. And, I haven't really been able to try them. So yeah. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I would obviously love to. Definitely something that I feel like I would really like to do before hanging up the bouldering shoes.
Yeah, and hopefully that's a long time from now.
Yes.
Okay, so this one says, not a loaded question, but does he think female athlete representation is improving within climbing?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was quite a male-dominated sport for a while.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's still a lot of improvement that can obviously happen. But yeah, it's awesome. It's so awesome to see. I mean, when I was a kid, I don't think I ever heard of a female doing a first ascent. And now you're seeing it a lot more. And then, I mean, it's awesome. I mean, I think the women's competitions are just as exciting as the males. And I think that the viewership, I mean, I'm not seeing the numbers, but I'm excited to watch both. And I really enjoy watching both. And I think the gap is getting so much smaller. I mean, when I was young, there was a massive gap between the best females and the best males. And now it's tiny.
Yeah.
You know, it's like 2 grades at most.
Yeah. It's pretty insane. I remember I was reading Lynn Hill's book and she would talk about, you know, when she first got into climbing, how it was kind of sexist and people didn't think she could do anything because she was a woman. And so it's really cool to see how far it's come and not that long of a time period.
Yeah. 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 And there's so much respect, I feel like now, so much more, respect from when I was a kid to now, just, in the ability of women, in competitions and at the crag and everything like that. I mean, I'm sure Yanya would probably make a final in a male World Cup if
she
was
a beast. She's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing. Yeah. And so, yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. So this is another one. How much does gym climbing and indoor training correlate to outdoor performance?
I think it depends on the person, for one. But also two, I think that there's no substitute for outdoor climbing. I think gym climbing is beneficial, especially something like the moon board or the kilter board, because I think it simulates it decently well. However, right, like let's just, I mean, these are very vague, but let's just say indoor climbing is 50% strength and 50% technique. Outdoor climbing, all of a sudden, it's, you know, 75-25.
Yeah.
And so it's putting that time in, right? It's like you can only gain so much technique in the gym. And so it's like, you know, like obviously, like I said, it depends on the person. For me, I've always been a very technical climber. And so like, if I don't go climb outside for 2 months and I just train, it's like, I go outside and after a day, I'm like, wow, I feel like I did 2 months ago when I was climbing outside all the time. But the thing is like, then it's the opposite. If I go climb outside for 2 months, I lose a lot of that strength that you get, because at the gym, you can climb so much more before you split a tip or like it gets dark outside or whatever. And so for me, I kind of have to spend a decent amount of time in the gym if I want to be climbing at a high level outside. Mm-hmm. But yeah, really just depends on the person.
Yeah. And it sounds like a pretty good balance of both. Like both provide different things.
Exactly.
Another one is, why moonboard and not spray wall at home?
Because I guess the easy answer is because I'm lazy when I go train. I mean, you know how it is. I mean, the moonboard's amazing. There's like 50,000 climbs on that thing.
It is hard too.
Yeah. And I don't want to just like, well, I love the lights.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, obviously I think a spray wall's cool. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about a spray wall, but for one, okay, one, laziness. I love going down in my basement and just like clicking on my phone V3 and I'm like, perfect, a great warm up. You know, and then just kind of going forwards from there. And like, if I want to set a climb that day, awesome. But I'm not forced to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I went with the moonboard over the spray wall. And then the other thing is I love the community. I love it. Like these like Korean guys, like
they are madmen.
I know. I love it. I just love it so much. And then there's like ravioli biceps and there's like these like moonboarders around the world, but then everyone moonboards, you know? I mean, everyone goes to the gym and moonboards, and it's so fun to like set climbs or like see a climb that a friend set, and or like I'll post something. Like the other day I set my first climb on the 2019 moonboard, and I screen capped it, made it my Instagram story, and then now a bunch of people are psyched and they're like going out and climbing on it, and I just love the social aspect of it. I think it's really fun to be able to share that with the whole world. Like the blue route at my climbing gym at Movement or whatever, no one else can go try that.
Yeah, I would agree. I love the boards and the apps because it creates a totally different community. And it also provides a creative outlet because, like you said, you can set new problems if you want. You can see what other people are doing. It's so fun. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So one more listener question is, how does Paul have such a strong mental game and how could one work towards it? We kind of touched on that before, but do you want to maybe elaborate a little more?
Yeah. I think experience comes into it, and then like, God, it's like, it's funny, right? Like we were talking about before, this like outsider perspective. It's like, God, if they could only get in my brain. Cause it's funny, right? You know, it's like you do, I think I talked about this on the Nugget. It's like you do 10 climbs and you climb them perfectly. And then the 11th climb, like you just can't figure it out. And all of a sudden you're just like in this terrible, I mean, obviously, you know, not depression, but, you know, for lack of a better word, depression hole, where you're like, I'm never going to climb a hard climb again. Like, and then all of a sudden you go to another climb and you're looking at a move and you're like doubting yourself. And then you fall on that move because you're doubting yourself. And so, yeah, I think for me, it's about like that consistency. When I have a good day, like I'll probably have another good day. And so I think the mental game is important because it's really easy to like have a bad day and just like dwell on that. But like, if we can build on our successes, and I think that a lot of people will see success as like, oh, I sent my first V3, but like, that's so few and far between, right? Because like maybe they're not going to send V4 until a year later.
Yeah.
And so that's like really demoralizing in a lot of ways, and it feels really tough because, you know, you're like, well, like I you know, people burn out for that reason because they're like, I haven't sent a V4 now and it's been 6 months. And so I think it's just really important, you know, you build a pyramid, right? It's like, you know, if you sent your first V3, that doesn't mean you should never try a V1 or V2 again. Like you should do all of them because that's just going to make you a better climber. And it's going to give you that confidence and it's going to help with the mental game. And also too, I mean, right. It's like not even about climbing the climb. It's like you go to the climbing gym and you tried something on the moon board and you go back the next day And all of a sudden, like one move either feels easier or like you moved your body in a different direction. You're like, you added to that book, right? You added to like, like if I'm in an undercling, like, and I drop knee, it feels really good. And then all of a sudden, like, that's a success. Like that's a huge mental success, because now when you see a similar move like that again, you're going to be able to do it that much quicker.
Yeah. And I mean, you can add your opinion here, but that was kind of my thinking when I told you, I think I'm going to spend the next year bouldering, is because I really want to consistently send 512s. And my thinking is, if I can walk up to pretty much any V4 and send it, I can probably do it on a rope, is my thinking. So I'm just trying to like consistently get a lot of boulders under my belt. That way, when I do go climb on a rope, it's like, oh, I can read this a bit easier now. Because that's really been the toughest part for me, is figuring it out.
And absolutely. Figuring it out, being strong. But also too, I mean, when you go, especially at the gym, I feel like rope climbing is kind of monotonous in a lot of ways. It's a lot of like left, right, left, right. But like going outside bouldering and stuff all the time, and going, going indoor bouldering, it's just, you're going to see so many more movements than you would see in sport climbing. Just, you know, bouldering is inherently just more kind of dynamic and like full body. You know, obviously not taking anything away from sport climbing in any way. You do see a multitude of movements in that, but it's just so much easier to see moves. And then also too, so much easier to try moves. Like you could try a V10 if you wanted to, like, and it's not that difficult. Whereas like, if you were like, oh, I want to go try a 514 today, then it's like, well, how the heck am I going to get my quick draws down? And it becomes just like such a more involved thing, that it's just, I feel like it's a lot easier to, it's not easier to gain endurance by bouldering, don't get me wrong, but like it's easier to gain knowledge and experience and like kind of like you're saying, that power. Like if you can climb every single V4, then like you sure as hell can climb a multitude of 512s.
Yeah, that's my thinking. So I'm excited to see where this goes. Yeah. So.
yeah, I'm excited for you to do that. I want to see you do that one, the Arete. I think it was like a 7 or an 8.
Yeah, I struggle. Like, this is my thing. I struggle with bouldering so much, but I have noticed that I was always like, oh, I'm bad at bouldering. And now I've stopped saying that. And I'm like, no, I'm just actually going to try. And I have been sending consistently. So I'm very excited to go back. And one I really want to try is called Camel Toe, actually. I choose like the ones with the worst names.
Wait, maybe that's the one. Maybe that's the word. Yes. Yeah. It's like an arete that goes up and right.
Yeah. It goes up and right and kind of like a crack feature, but not really. It looks like a crack, but it's not. And then it kind of goes, diagonal and then up to like this slopey, kind of scary looking top out.
Okay.
I want to do it so bad. And I feel like it's going to happen eventually, because I walked up to it and got to the crux. And so I was like, okay, if I can do that without any sort of bouldering experience, I can do it if I actually try.
There you go. And also too, now you know how to set up a rope around a tree.
Exactly.
So you can practice the top out.
Yeah, which is, I think, going to be the most mental part for me. So I think that's a great idea.
Plus it's nice too, because if you go set up a top rope, then you don't have to go out there if you don't have a partner that day, then you can just go try it yourself and not be scared.
Yeah, which is actually something you bring up a good point, because I haven't really been able to find anyone around to go do it. And I'm like, I want to go try it. So maybe I'll just go out there by myself.
There you go.
That's awesome. So, okay, to kind of wrap up, as I told you earlier today, every episode that I have a guest, I have them choose a charity or cause that they want to spread the word about and have people donate to or volunteer. So which one did you choose? And can you tell us about it?
Yeah. I chose UNICEF. I think most people kind of know about UNICEF, but I just did, when you asked me, I just did a little bit of research, and I just wanted to find an organization that, you know, it's important that the money is going to the cause.
Yes.
Because a lot of them are doing weird things. And I think I read somewhere that UNICEF only takes a max of 4% of every donation. But and yes, and it got me excited too. So I'm going to donate to UNICEF as well. And so, yeah, I just feel like every day we're seeing a tragedy, right? You know, I mean, this Texas school shooting and this war in Ukraine is just so sad to me. You know, it's like, and the UNICEF, I know it does a lot of work with children and families, and it just sucks, right? You know, I mean, it's like, look at us, like for the past hour and a half, we've been talking about like going to go try our project, or like, you know, going to Rocklands this summer, and like, just like how much privilege that is. And yeah, it's, you know, I mean, we don't get to choose where we're born, and like, you know, you and I and our friends and family and stuff, we're all very, very lucky to be, to be born where we are. And that's not really the case for everyone. And, you know, it's very, very true. And in our eyes right now, seeing like just the absolute tragedies that are occurring, in Eastern Europe right now. So, yeah, so that's why I chose UNICEF. And God, it's so sad. And it just makes you really feel the privilege that we all have, because, you know, it's pretty special that we could end this conversation today and we could both drive to the climbing gym and have really no fear of being bombed or, you know, our entire country like going to complete hell.
Yeah, we're definitely very lucky. And that's actually why I started the whole choose a charity or a cause, because I think any way that I could help and spread that awareness is something.
Yeah, I love that. I really love that. That's super cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I will put all of the info for UNICEF in the show notes of this episode, along with your socials. Where can people find you?
Okay. Yeah. Paul Robinson 87 on Instagram and YouTube as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. That was super fun.
Thanks again for tuning into this episode of the Bound for Everywhere podcast. Don't forget to check out UNICEF and Paul on all socials. All of this information, as always, will be linked in the show notes. And until next time, remember that adventure begins when you step into the unknown and stay bound for everywhere.